The Human Adventure. From station WGN with the University of Chicago for the radio audience of the Middle West. These Wednesday evenings, through science and scholarship, enter with us upon a new search toward the fuller understanding of our universe, ourselves, and our society. Our special host is Malcolm Sharp, professor of law at the University of Chicago. Our story is the story of man's search for knowledge, which is science, his search for wisdom, which is scholarship, the adventure in ideas, which is the human adventure. This night, the champion of the living law. This hour, the story of Mr. Associate Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. First, there is Captain David Holmes, who fought the Indians in 1758. And there is his wife, Temperance, who later told her son,
"When I was a girl, I begged to go to school with the boys. But the elders were angry and said Latin was not for a woman's head. Go home, Tempy, they said, and learn to spin and weave." So I taught myself to read Virgil.
Then there is the son of David and Temperance, whose name is Abiel, who became minister of the first parish in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Abiel Holmes, with the sternness and hellfire of old-time Calvinism, who one Sunday in 1809 passed judgment on a woman of his congregation.
"I pronounce this woman to be a person from whom the followers of Christ are to withdraw as from one who walketh disorderly. The sentence now passed is but a representation of a sentence inconceivably more awful to be passed at the judgment seat of Christ."
Unsmiling old Abiel Holmes, who had a son he named Oliver. One night, the bitter Boston cold had frosted the window pane of young Oliver's room. Old Abiel came to say good night. He stood before the window and with his finger wrote some words on the pane.
"What did you put on the window, Father?"
"Per aspera ad astra, my boy."
"What's that mean, per aspera ad astra?"
"That means through adversity to the stars. Remember that, Oliver. Remember it and tell it to your children. Through adversity to the stars."
The son Oliver is Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr., gay son of a severe father, eminent physician, wit, poet, friend of Emerson, Lowell, and Longfellow, autocrat of the breakfast table, so different from old Abiel that he was able to say such things as,
"Madam," said I, "society is the same in all large places. I divide it thus. People of cultivation who live in large houses. People of cultivation who live in small houses. People without cultivation who live in large houses. People without cultivation who live in small houses. And scrubs." An individual at the upper end of the table turned pale and left the room as I finished with the monosyllable.
On the 9th of March, 1841, Dr. O.W. Holmes wrote his sister, Anne. His letter was facetious. His news was great. He wrote,
"My dear Anne, last evening, between 8 and 9, there appeared at number 8 Montgomery Place, Cambridge, Massachusetts, a little individual who may hereafter be addressed as Blank Holmes, Esquire, or the Honorable Blank Holmes, Member of Congress, or His Excellency Blank Holmes, President, etc., etc., but who for the present is content with scratching his face and sucking his right forefinger."
Blank Holmes got a name. Blank Holmes became Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, author of the Common Law, for 30 years an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. But more than all that, he became a great scholar who made the law live, a great jurist who through adversity reached the stars, a strong American who saw the law as the ordering and discipline of a great people upon the human adventure.
1861, Oliver Wendell Holmes graduated from Harvard. He was the class poet, but he did not write the class poem in the quiet of a student's room. He wrote it between drill periods at Fort Independence, where he was training for an experience that was far from poetry. He delivered the poem at commencement exercises in May 1861. His famous father was there, and his father's friends. They listened, and then they said...
Well, sir, Dr. Holmes, this is a proud day for you.
I think Wendell did splendidly. A lovely poem.
Yes. Felicity sprays here and there. I dare say I could have improved it a trifle had the boy brought the manuscript to me.
Is Wendell following you into medicine, Doctor, or has he inherited more of your literary talent?
Well, Wendell has no particular mind of his own. I dare say it's a lucky thing for him that this war's come along. Makes up his mind for him.
He's gone into the army, then? Oh, I'm sure he'll make a handsome soldier.
Well, if his shooting is as straight as his posture, he'll make a handsome soldier indeed.
Oh, Dr. Holmes, you do put things so cleverly. You have a phrase for everything.
The Boston casualties in the Battle of Ball's Bluff were Captain Putnam, right arm amputated, Captain Pearson, raking wound in the back, O.W. Holmes, wounded in the abdomen, Captain Dreher, shot in both thighs.
A year later, out of the battle at Antietam came a telegram for Dr. Holmes. It read,
"Your son, Captain Holmes, wounded. Shot through the neck. Thought not to be mortal."
Down, men! Down!
Keep down!
Have you heard about young Holmes at Chancellorsville? Got it for the third time, poor devil. Tore off half his heel and prayed to Dickens with ligaments and tendons. I dare say he'll see no more action. Fact is, young Holmes has seen enough action for one lifetime.
Enough action for one life, for some men, perhaps. But that all depends on what you mean by action. 30 years later, when he was Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, Oliver Wendell Holmes made a speech and had his say about what action was and when a man had had enough of it.
War, when you're at it, is horrible and dull. It's only when time has passed that you see its message. I hope it may be long before we are called again to sit at that master's feet, but some teacher of the kind we all need. For the joy of life is living, to put out all one's powers as far as they will go. The measure of power is obstacles overcome. Ride boldly at what is in front of you, be it fence or enemy. Pray not for comfort, but for combat. Keep the soldier's faith against the doubts of civil life, more besetting and harder to overcome than all the misgivings of the battlefield.
That was Holmes 30 years after the Civil War. He was 53 then. He was midstream. But where was the beginning? Why did a man with Holmes' fire, with Holmes' love of action, choose the law? Men asked him why he chose. He answered them all. He answered his father when old Dr. Holmes told him,
"A lawyer can't be a great man.
Every calling is great when greatly pursued."
And when he read that Disraeli had said,
"The law is a dismal science."
What other profession gives such scope to realize the spontaneous energy of one's soul? In what other does one plunge so deep in the stream of life? So share its passions, its battles, its despair, its triumphs, both as witness and actor.
An English barrister once told a student,
"If you can eat sawdust without butter, young man, you will be a success in the law."
No result is easy which is worth having. No man has earned the right to intellectual ambition until he has learned to lay his course by a star which he has never seen, to dig by the divining rod for springs which he may never reach.
There was Burke who said,
"The law sharpens the mind by narrowing it."
The law is the calling of thinkers.
Or the novelist Thackeray who said,
"A good lawyer is a man who bends all the powers of a great mind to a mean profession."
And Wendell Holmes only answered,
"Gentlemen, to our mistress,
the law." The Holmes toast is the law, but the Holmes practice is but briefly the practice of law, the round of a young lawyer just out of Harvard. He gives up practice and returns to study. Striving to understand his chosen mistress, he undertakes with a soldier's fierceness to rewrite the great law treatise, Kent's Commentaries. And of the student Holmes, Mrs. James of Boston writes to her own brilliant son, Harry,
"Wendell Holmes dined with us a few days ago. He's utterly absorbed in his work upon Kent. His pallid face and his fearful grip upon his work make him a melancholy sight."
Read, work, annotate. Dry as dust, these books Holmes takes back from the library, perhaps. But Holmes builds with them. Each book a new layer in the mountain of knowledge that is also a mountain of life. Not just, what is the law now? Not just, what is American law today? But rather, what is the law? What is its meaning? Why is the law? Get to the roots, go back into time, build a mountain of knowledge, and from the top of that mountain, see the cosmos. Then be a lawyer. Then be a judge. But first, learn, read, learn. Stephen's History of English Law, Montesquieu's Spirit of the Law, Bracton's Relation to the Roman Law, Forsyth's History of Trial by Jury, Maine's Ancient Law, Bacon's Elements, Grotius.
And if you ask me, Holmes will never get anywhere with all this silly bookwormish plodding. Well, the chap's 40 years old and doesn't have an office, let alone a client. Rather a shame, I'd say. He's quite a good fellow, you know.
I really couldn't say. But I've heard he is to deliver the lower lectures next month. Rather a feather in his cap. Absolutely everyone who's anyone in Boston will be there.
We shall be bored stiff, no doubt.
Higginson tells me it's to be quite a revolutionary bit called the Common Law. Really, though, as I say, I wouldn't know much about it.
Those lectures on the Common Law, later published in book form, are now famous in legal history. Among the many things Holmes said then was,
"The life of the law has not been logic. It has been experience. The very considerations which judges most rarely mention, and always with an apology, are the secret root from which the law draws all the juices of life. I mean, of course, considerations of what is expedient for the community concerned."
The preparation is done. Now comes action. Harvard Law School makes him a professor, but he teaches only briefly before he is called to the bench of the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, of which he became Chief Justice. Then on December 8, 1902, the Holmes voice was able to say of an appointment to a mightier court,
"I, Oliver Wendell Holmes, do solemnly swear that I will administer justice without respect to persons, and to persons, and do equal right to the poor and to the rich, and that I will faithfully and impartially discharge and perform all the duties incumbent upon me as Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, according to the best of my abilities and understanding, agreeably to the Constitution and laws of the United States. So help me God."
From 1902 to 1932, Justice Holmes sat on the Supreme Court, where his opinions were profoundly to influence not only the status of the law, but also the lives and thought of all Americans. Yet in 1902, some said,
"Why, the fellow's an old land Boston aristocrat, a blue blood conservative of the most ancient sort. A man with his background's automatically a Tory. Anyone can see that."
"Alfred says that when this Holmes was a judge in Massachusetts, he made some decisions, or whatever they called them, that prove he's a very dangerous man. Alfred says he's a radical. Says he wouldn't be surprised if the man were an out-and-out anarchist."
Soon those opinions came to test. America was soon to know if Wendell Holmes' ultra-conservative background dominated his mind, whether Holmes was a man more spacious than his own heritage, a jurist who judged the law by the way he felt about it or by the pedantic methods of justice. The first big test was in 1905 in the case of...
Lochner versus the state of New York.
Lochner versus New York. This case tested whether a legislature could control the hours of work an employer could demand of his workmen. The decision of the court was 5-4 that the legislature could not control workmen's hours of work, that to do so was a violation of liberty of contract guaranteed by the Constitution. Holmes did not agree with the conservative majority, so he wrote a dissent in which he gave the world a glimpse of great judicial impartiality.
Justice Holmes dissenting.
This case is decided upon an economic theory which a large part of the country does not entertain. If it were a question of whether I agreed with that theory, I should desire to study it further and long before making up my mind. But I do not conceive that to be my duty, because I strongly believe that my agreement or disagreement has nothing to do with the right of the majority to embody their opinions in law. I think that the word liberty in the 14th Amendment is perverted when it is held to prevent the natural outcome of a dominant opinion. I regret sincerely that I am unable to agree with the judgment in this case, and that I think it my duty to express my dissent.
Twelve years later, in Bunting versus Oregon, the Supreme Court thinks better of the matter, overrules its opinion, and swings around to Holmes. This is the beginning. His dissents are so important, so powerful, and so influential that he earns the title of the great dissenter. What were some of these Holmes dissents?
Atkins versus Children's Hospital.
Whether Congress can establish minimum rates of wages or whether Congress has no power to meddle with the matter at all.
Justice Holmes dissenting.
To me, notwithstanding the difference due to the prevailing judgment of the court, the power of Congress seems absolutely free from doubt. The end, to remove conditions leading to ill health, immorality, and the deterioration of the race, no one would deny to be within the scope of constitutional legislation. I am of the opinion that the statute is valid and that the decree of this court should be reversed.
That was 1923. By 1941, the Supreme Court in this matter was overruled by itself. And in another case...
Hammer versus Dagenhart.
Whether Congress, by exercising its power to regulate commerce among the states, can forbid the traffic of the products of child labor from one state into another, and thus largely abolish child labor itself.
Justice Holmes dissenting.
If there is any matter upon which civilized countries have agreed, it is the evil of premature and excessive child labor. It is not for this court to say that a phrase in the Constitution may allow Congress to forbid traffic of strong drink, but that the same phrase may not be used by Congress to prohibit traffic of the products of the ruined lives of children. The public policy of the United States is shaped with a view to the benefit of the nation as a whole. It seems to me entirely constitutional for Congress to enforce its understanding by all the means at its command.
That was in 1918. By 1941, the Supreme Court had unanimously overruled itself in favor of these opinions of Oliver Wendell Holmes. To do justice when he did not sympathize with a defendant is part of Holmes' philosophy and greatness. Nowhere is this more apparent than in the great cases concerning freedom of speech. One such case is...
Abrams versus the United States.
A few men in America, in fiery sympathy for the cause of the Russian Revolution in 1917, published angry propaganda pamphlets. The authors were brought to trial in a case that eventually reached the Supreme Court, which upheld the conviction and sentence of the lower courts. But not all the Supreme Court.
Justice Holmes dissenting.
In this case, sentences of 20 years imprisonment have been imposed for publishing two leaflets that I believe the defendants had as much right to publish as the government has to publish the Constitution of the United States. Even if I'm technically wrong, the most nominal punishment seems to me all that possibly could be inflicted, unless the defendants are to be made to suffer not for what the indictment alleges, but for the creed they avow. A creed that I believe to be the creed of ignorance and immaturity, but which, although made the subject of examination at the trial, no one has a right to even consider in dealing with charges before the court. The Constitution is an experiment, as all life is an experiment. While that experiment is part of our system, I think we should be eternally vigilant against attempts to check the expression of opinions that we loathe. I regret that I cannot put into more impressive words my belief that in their conviction upon this indictment, the defendants were deprived of their rights under the Constitution of the United States.
By 1941, Holmes' opinion in this case, too, had become the law. Thus, for 30 years, Oliver Wendell Holmes, with serenity, with force, with a fighting intellect, translates the obscure words of the law into most meaningful and passionate pieces of life. How long can a man keep up the fight? When does a man have the right to quit and take it easy? When his country honored him at the end of his 90th year of fighting the good fight, Wendell Holmes said,
"In this symposium, my only part is to sit in silence, to express one's feelings as the end draws near is too intimate a task. But I may mention one thought that comes to me as a listener in. The riders in a race do not stop short when they reach the goal. There is a little finishing canter before coming to a standstill. There is time to hear the kind voice of friends, and to say to oneself, the work is done. But just as one says that, the answer comes. The race is over, but the work is never done, while the power to work remains. The canter that brings you to a standstill need not be only coming to a rest. It cannot be while you still live. For to live is to function. That is all there is in living. And so I end with a line from a Latin poet who uttered the message more than 1,500 years ago. Death plucks my ear and says, live. I am coming.
A man doesn't live forever. Sooner or later, age takes hold and a man feels sleepy and his mind isn't what it used to be. Wendell Holmes knew that. A clerk in the Supreme Court tells how it was. He says that the court had sat all morning that day in 1932 and Mr. Justice Holmes had delivered an opinion.
Court is adjourned.
As the court was adjourned, the clerk turned to a friend to say,
Jim, I think the old boy is slipping.
Oh, I wouldn't quite say that. Just that when a man is over 90, his voice isn't quite so loud, you know.
Yeah, but it was different today. Why, I could hardly hear him. His words were jumbled. Awfully hard to take notes. And did you see him almost doze off there for a moment? Now, if you ask me, Mr. Holmes ought to retire.
Well, but Mr. Holmes thinks he ought to retire, he will. I'd say the old boy is good for another 5 years.
Mr. Dunn.
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Holmes.
Would you come here a moment, please?
Certainly, sir. Is anything the matter, Mr. Holmes?
No. Nothing is the matter. But I should like to have you deliver a message to my colleagues for me.
Yes, sir?
Please tell them that I won't be down tomorrow.
I won't be down tomorrow. The end comes quietly when you're over 90. But it is not the end. It is the life itself that counts.
In March 1935, 2 days before his 94th birthday, Oliver Wendell Holmes died.
Per aspera ad astra.
Through adversity to the stars.
Now, our special host, Malcolm Sharp, professor of law of the University of Chicago.
Mr. Justice Holmes' greatness consisted partly in his ability to keep two contrasting ideas in his mind at the same time. Most of us like a neat universe. We go about tidying up our own universes to suit our wishes, to soften our fears, and to conceal from ourselves the drama in our lives. His soldier's life had its own glory. He was proud of his Civil War wounds. He was part of a generation which glorified enterprise, adventure, and struggle. He belonged to an age of imperialism. Yet in one dissenting opinion, Holmes attacked a majority decision which denied naturalization to a woman of 50 who, as a pacifist, said she would not take up arms in war. Holmes said, "She is an optimist, and states in strong, and I do not doubt sincere words, her belief that war will disappear. I do not share that optimism, nor do I think that a philosophical view of the world would regard war as absurd. Here appears a toleration which goes with his toughness, a sense of the variety and contradiction in life, the sense also of an adjustment, which can draw from the contradiction a degree, at least, of harmony. Not only toleration, but a warm sympathy leads him to say, I would suggest that the Quakers have done their share to make the country what it is, that many citizens agree with this woman's belief, and that I have not supposed hitherto that we regretted our inability to expel them because they believe more than some of us do in the Sermon on the Mount. This ability to keep different ideas in mind at once gave Holmes a unique position among our great justices. He had grave doubts whether unions or minimum wage legislation would do workmen as a group any good whatever. He believed in individual liberty and industrial productivity alike required a considerable opportunity for businessmen to amass wealth. Nevertheless, when legislatures and Congress passed laws to encourage unionization and to set minimum wages, he was a pioneer in insisting against the majority of the court that these enactments must be upheld. Holmes said, I should have my doubts whether the price that has to be paid for every gain was not greater than the gain was worth, a matter that it is not for me to decide. The justice recognized that legislatures and the Congress, not the courts, are the policymakers. He refrained steadfastly from holding that his economic opinions could be read into the vague words of the federal Constitution. Holmes insisted that the citizens, through their legislative bodies, must be left free to make their own bets on the future.
The Human Adventure is jointly presented by Station WGN and the University of Chicago. Selected programs are transcribed for rebroadcast by the Overseas Network of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Music was by Kenneth Churchill, the conductor Henry Weber. The part of Justice Holmes was played by Herbert Butterfield. The writer, in cooperation with the University of Chicago, John D. Hess, the script editor Francis Coughlin, and the director Morrison Wood. 1 week from tonight, The Human Adventure will present Tall Tale America, a legendary history of our humorous heroes.
That's next week, January 30th, Tall Tale America, a legendary history of our humorous heroes.
This is WGN Chicago, serving the Middle West.